Bills this afternoon. You are the only case on our afternoon docket for oral submission. We appreciate your patience while we had a little panel change here. I'm obviously not Chief Justice Sutterith, and so and Judge Pittman,
I'm not either.
And Judge Pittman has joined us, so we're very glad. And of course, you know Judge Meyer, so we are your panel.
That's
and if you
matter.
All are ready to proceed, I will have the clerk call your case. You ready to proceed, Mr. Quast?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Our clerk will call the case just for our recording.
The court will now call the City of Crowley versus Doug. Mr. Frederick Quast will argue for the appellant. Mr. John R. Lively will argue for the appellee.
May it please the court, Fritz Quast, on behalf of the City of Crowley. I'm always here on behalf of some beautiful burg in the suburbs. I'm going to try to avoid just rehashing what's in the brief. I think there's some things that I, in particular, didn't maybe touch on very well in the brief that I'd like to go through. But, of course, if the judges want to take me somewhere else, that's fine. But just a couple of factual things that I'm not sure that are very well put out in the briefing. Essentially, this is a 4-acre property in the City of Crowley. The appellee, Mr. Doug Gray, bought it in 1999, May 24th of 1999, with the intent, and there were two-acre tracts, with the intent to develop it entirely as multifamily, actually fourplexes. He was, I think, at one point trying to put at least 23 lots, one fourplex per lot, on the 4-acre piece of property. There's a creek that runs just to the south and a little bit on the property. It proceeds a little bit to the north on the eastern edge of the property, and then it goes under a street and then a railroad culvert. Now, if you want to say that there's a bad guy in this case, and if you look at any map, the floodway and the floodplain, regardless of what you look at, regardless of what version you look at, it gets really wide at Mr. Ray's property. So the reason for that is noted on the first page of the NAVE study. It comes out and says, look, once it goes under that street, when there is a 100-year flood event, that railroad, raised railroad bed, acts as a dam, and it backs water up on the property. That is why there is an issue here. This is nothing that Mr. Ray did, really. It's nothing that the city did, really. It's just the lay of the land. Now, back in 1995, there was the first time a flood map was purchased on the property. The entire property was in a shaded zone X. What that means very simply is that's the estimate of where the 500-year floodplain is. We don't know where the actual 100-year, which is the regulatory floodplain, is within that zone. It's in there somewhere. But as early as 1995, we knew that there were going to be potential flooding problems on this particular piece of property. 1998, there was a study performed for a subdivision to the south. And I forget the name of the subdivision, but the engineer's name was Jerry Parchet. Poor guy, he's gotten his name dragged in the mud, through no fault of his own, really. And essentially, it was submitted to FEMA, and the Zone X was changed to show a 100-year floodplain and a floodway. So from the railroad culvert to about 17 feet upstream, there was an actual mapping done. At the time, Mr. Ray bought it in late May of 1999. That's what the map looked like. The map was corrected right after he purchased the property, but that was a typographical error. It had nothing to do with the location of the 100-year floodplain or the floodway on the property. August 9th, 1999, Mr. Ray submits a preliminary plat of the entire 4 acres to the city of Crowley. That's Defendant's Exhibit Number 41, 42, something like that. In September of 1999, this is Defendant's Exhibit 9. You got a fax from his engineer. Her name is Shelley Hatton. And she said this on the fax. Doug, as you can see, and she attaches the 99 letter of map revision. Doug, as you can see, there is now a floodway located on your property based on the revised flood insurance rate map. Call me so we can go over some options. Now, you know, just so the court is clear, there is a little bit of a distinction between what is a floodplain and what is a floodway. Essentially, usually the floodplain is smaller, skinnier than the floodplain, and essentially it takes, you have to go through greater regulatory hurdles to be able to build on it or deposit fill in it or obstruct it in any way. It's essentially a sacrosanct piece of the floodplain. So she said there's floodway on your property. We don't know what Mr. Ray's response, in his testimony, he says, I don't remember that conversation. I don't remember receiving that fax, which, you know, that's fair. It was 15 years ago.
But it's really not any of that that Ray is contending constitutes the taking, isn't it? Isn't it the having to raise the level of the land by 2 feet?
Your Honor, the regulations are imposed on us by FEMA, and it says whatever the floodplain is, unless you do certain things, you have to raise the level of the finished floor elevations above 2 feet. But the city of Crowley does not determine where those lines are on the map. That is something that is solely done by the Federal Emergency Management Agency. So the preliminary plat was approved, and later Mr. Ray decided to develop the property into two phases. His first phase was approved, a final plat was approved. He put 6 fourplexes on there. Steps 24 units. He ran them for about a year at about $850 a pop. He sold all 6 lots to investors in California for about $242,000 a lot.
Okay, Mr. Frost, I'm sorry, I misread my notes. Doesn't the city require Ray to raise the minimum finished floor to 10 feet above the effective floodplain, not just 2?
Well, that is a great question. No. Look, what they're trying to do here is they're trying to say, look, we've got this flood study, and it says that the parche and the effective map are wrong. But because of certain things that have occurred, that flood study has not gone to FEMA, and it never will unless he develops the property. So now we're caught between a rock and a hard place. They want us now to ignore his own engineer's flood study that says that the existing flood map was flawed. And the reason why it was flawed is this. There's a difference between the rational basis and the unit hydrograph method concerning how you estimate the amount of water in a particular channel during a 100-year flood event. The rational basis method just kind of dreams up a fraction, and you say, well, how big is your property? How big is the watershed? Maybe there's some differentiation in the fractions depending on what the land use is, and that's how you tell how much water is going to be in the creek during a 100-year flood event. The hydrograph method is much more detailed. You look at the land use, you look at the soil composition, you look at all these other things. And so when Ray came in and got his preliminary plat approved on the southern 2.7 acres, we said, look, the watershed is more than 200 acres, so you should do a new study that uses the unit hydrograph method. Nobody dreamed that it would come in like this. So instead of the floodplain affecting a third to a quarter of his property, the 2.7 acres, it essentially covers all of it. But again, what did the city do? The city required him to investigate the flood hazards on his property, as we're required to do under the National Flood Insurance Program. We had no way to foresee that it was going to be or have this much impact on him. Now, at the time he got the flood study back, the record does not reflect it very well, but I think we can, everybody believes, Mr. Ray was not very happy. This was going to cost him thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars to bring in fill and construct engineered retaining walls to be able to build as many fourplexes as he wanted to build. But again, what did the city do? We said get a flood study done. Investigate your property. Figure out what's wrong with your property. Tell us what the flood hazards are on your property using a more accurate hydrology methodology. So why have those numbers never gone to FEMA? There are several ways it can get to FEMA. Before a development is done, there's something called a conditional letter of map revision. After development is completed, there's called a letter of map revision. And then when new floodplain determinations are done, there's a certain time period whereby you can appeal those maps to FEMA. So in this instance, the city suggested to Ray that if you wanted to avoid doing a CLOMER, which was going to cost them about $4,000, if you want to avoid doing a conditional letter of map revision to FEMA, you can do something called a no-rise certificate. Now, all it is your engineer comes in and they say, and they swear, that, hey, if we put this fill in the floodplain, it's not going to raise the water upstream or downstream. He said, what's that? Doesn't have to do a CLOMER. The NEMI study doesn't go to FEMA. Now, in his testimony, he says, it's going to be too expensive. I'm never going to develop this property. That means there's never going to be an application for a letter of map revision. So we're not going to do a CLOMER because he opted out. We're not going to do a letter of map revision because he is not going to develop the property. The only other way to get the NEMI study to FEMA is through the appeal period after a new map is approved. Now, there was one in 99, but that, you know, there was one in 2009, a new map published. But the new map was not based on the NEMI study. It was based on more accurate topographical information. So in other words, they were taking information about the lay of the land and putting it in the equations. The NEMI study could have gone to FEMA then, but Mr. Ray did not appeal that to FEMA during the 90-day time period.
Mr. Cross, what is the date of the FEMA map that the city contends is in effect right now, and was in effect during the process that Mr. Ray was attempting to get his subdivision approved?
September the 25th of 2009. Now, you may ask yourself, the burden to appeal a new map or new floodway determination lays both on property owners and the city. Either can do it. Okay. But at the time that new map was published on September the 25th of 2009, we were faced with a lawsuit, an earlier version of this lawsuit, where he was first trying to force us to use the 1999 letter of map provision. So the determination was made, we're not going to appeal to FEMA. He's trying to force us to use the old numbers. So now we're faced with a situation to where he's saying, well, look, you're making me raise my property or my finished floor elevation 10 feet above what's really effective. And we cannot.
I follow your logic, counsel. You're saying that because the city was in a lawsuit, they got an excuse not to appeal to FEMA?
I'm not saying we have an excuse. I'm saying that they're saying it was our job to appeal to FEMA. I'm saying that it is.
I just heard you say, at least I thought, that the reason it wasn't appealed is because you were in a lawsuit against the Ray, against Mr. Ray, therefore you didn't appeal it?
No. He was trying to force us to use the old 1999 letter of map revision, the Parche study, in other
words. Okay, so what does that have to do with you appealing the 2009 map and whether the city had a duty to appeal that decision?
I don't believe there's anything in the regulations or the National Flood Insurance Act that requires us to appeal. As a matter of fact, I think really what it is the property owner has the primary duty to appeal any problems he sees with a particular map. And an appeal is the only way to get the problem that's at issue here before FEMA. Now, appeals can be triggered by letters of map revision, but the only way to appeal that something is technically or scientifically incorrect with the map is during the appeal period. And
so what you're saying is this 10-foot requirement isn't required but should be required?
Yes. And what I'm telling you is the FEMA regulations mandate that we cannot overlook a study that's been given to us. Now, they're saying, why haven't you given it to FEMA? We haven't given it to FEMA because the appeal periods ran, and because you declined to do a conditional letter of map revision, and because you're refusing to develop the property, and therefore there's no letter of map revision application. So we're essentially caught. Therefore, there's never been a final decision, and there's never been any regulatory action by the city. There's never been a final decision by FEMA. Now, let's take two different sides of this.
So there's no vehicle for you to provide this information to FEMA. That's what you're telling us.
Not
there's absolutely no vehicle for you to provide the information to FEMA, because if you could, you would, and FEMA would require the 10-foot, and then it wouldn't be a taking by you.
That is correct. That is correct. Now, we could, I guess, drop it in the mail and mail it to them, but they're under no obligation to amend the map. And as a matter of fact, the regulations specifically say that the only way to contend that the methodology is wrong, which is here, unit hydrograph versus the rational basis, the only way to do that is during an appeal period. That is the only way to accept that kind of information. And those appeal periods ran.
Well, surely there's some other situation, either with the city of Crowley or some other city, when something akin to this has come up.
I have looked long and hard for it, and I have been unable to locate a procedural vehicle where we could resolve this. But again, Mr. Ray doesn't want us to use his engineer's numbers, because that is very financially burdensome to him.
Who did the September 25th, 2009 study?
That was not a study. That was simply FEMA updating the maps with better topographical information. In other words, the study...
FEMA based their decision to update on somebody's study, didn't they?
No, that's not always the case. When I say study here, I'm talking about a hydrology study. In other words, where the watershed is studied, and it's determined how much water is going to be in a particular location on a channel during a particular magnitude of rain event.
Somebody's guess about how much water is going to accumulate on this land, given the topographical features of the land, and given the assumption that there's going to be so much water coming out of the sky that it will cause this kind of accumulation of water on this property.
Just as my, I do believe all of this is just a guess. There's so many variables and factors involved. I've heard engineers refer to it as hydrology voodoo, but it's the best we can do. I'm way out of time here.
You're answering very important questions, and we'll give the other side additional time. I studied these briefs, and I must tell you that all of these acronyms get to running together in my mind when I start looking at LOMRs and FIRMs and all the other various things to try to put this into a logical basis. But I want to ask you this. Your contention is, and I've heard you say more than once this morning or this afternoon, that the city has never imposed a requirement on Mr. Ray to raise the finished floor elevations in the proposed construction on the 2.7 acres by 10 feet.
We have required him to submit a final plat and a site plan consistent with the study his engineer performed. Whether those numbers in that study are correct because of the procedural posture here, it will apparently never go to FEMA unless something drastic happens. So we're caught between a rock and a hard place. We don't know what FEMA will do with the NAVE study. If the NAVE study, if they say, oh, the NAVE study is wrong, they're just wrong, or they're not completely accurate, we think the floodplain is actually a little smaller, that's some relief that he could get from FEMA. That's a lack of final decision rightness, and that's failure to exhaust administrative remedies, issue one. If we assume that FEMA is going to look at the NAVE study and go, we love this study. This study is perfect. This is what the map should look like. The taking is not ours. It's the federal government's.
Don't you think it is a bit of a reach for the city of Crowley to make its decisions on issuing of permits by what is a guess about what might happen in a federal agency?
No, absolutely not, Your Honor. The federal regulations impose a duty on the city to not ignore. Everyone agrees that this is the more accurate methodology to use to estimate how much water is in the creek. We can't ignore it. If we ignore it, we risk losing our coverage under the National Flood Insurance Program, getting kicked out of the program, and having everyone in Crowley have to pay exorbitant amounts for flood insurance or not being able to afford it at all. So there is no choice. We have to follow the NAVE study.
Okay, thank you for answering my question, sir.
If you would please add 2 minutes time for Mr. Lively's argument.
Mr. Lively, how's your computer doing?
Battery's a little low. But no malware.
Counsel, I'm alluding to his presentation at the Bench Bar Conference recently.
I remember it well, Your Honor. Were you scared?
No.
It's the county's problem, right?
Yes.
May it please the court. My name is John Lively, Jr. I'm here today on behalf of the appellee, Mr. Doug Ray. I'd like to start with a little bit of background on the case, just for the court's edification, as how we got here. You may notice that the case number ends in 09, or begins with an 09. This is a 2009 case. It was filed June 12, 09, when the plaintiff filed its original petition against both the city of Crowley and also Tignall and Perkins, which was the city's engineers. Essentially, the causes of action were breach of contract, professional negligence, negligent misrepresentation, breach of implied warranty, and a request for declaratory judgment. There was an original plea to the jurisdiction that was filed back then, had nothing to do with the plea to the jurisdiction, which we are here for today. However, that did come up with the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals upheld the court's denial of the plea to the jurisdiction, went back to the trial court. There was a summary judgment that was filed by both parties. The court, after hearing the summary judgment, looking at all the evidence that was provided by the two defendants and the plaintiff, determined that based upon the facts of this case, it was an inverse condemnation case, a takings case. The court, now Justice Birdwell, allowed the plaintiff leave to amend its pleadings. That was in November of 2014, and that is when the plaintiff added the inverse condemnation claim, also a negligent misrepresentation claim. The court subsequently granted the summary judgment and dismissed all of the remaining causes of action. So the only thing remaining in this case is essentially the inverse condemnation case. Subsequently, that is when Crowley filed another motion for summary judgment and pleaded the jurisdiction in August of 2016. So from November of 14, when the court announced the way it was going to rule, I believe it wasn't until maybe June that it actually entered an order. It was sometime between the two. But Crowley subsequently filed their plea to the jurisdiction, which was set multiple times but finally heard on February 21st, 2017. Then 9 months later, on November 15th, 2017, the court entered the order denying the plea to the jurisdiction and then also entered the findings of fact and conclusions of law. And I think those are very important to the court and will probably be very illustrative of the facts, both the facts of the case and the findings that the court made based on the evidence he heard. The court heard one day of testimony. We actually were there for trial, we thought, but after we got into the plea of the jurisdiction that the court took up first and heard evidence till about 4:30 that day, the court recessed the trial and then made its rulings that now are on the record of the court. The plea to the jurisdiction, and then subsequently notice of appeal was filed. The plea to the jurisdiction was initially denied. Crowley filed the plea asserting that Ray's claims against the city for the regulatory taking are not ripe for judicial review, and therefore the trial court did not have jurisdiction. The facts that are pertinent to this, Mr. Cross went through a long history of what the city did, what Mr. Ray did, all back before the second phase came into existence. But I think what is very illustrative here is, as Justice Meyer pointed out, there are a lot of acronyms here. But the two that are most important is the letter of map revision, which is dated July 20th, 1999, along with the firm map of 1995 and the FIS report, F-I-S. These are what constitute or tell the citizens of Crowley where the floodplain is. What is the elevation of the 100-year floodplain? And as he said, it's just a guess as to if that will ever occur. Mr. Ray has testified that he's owned this land since 1999. We have had some torrential rainstorms and the highest flooding we've had on record, and that property never did flood. Now, the elevation of where the 100-year floodplain is set forth in that 1999 map. As Mr. Cross previously stated, in 1995, in the firm map, it was designated Zone X. What that means is in order to determine where the actual floodplain is, further, more detailed studying must be done. And that is what was done with the Parche study. So from the firm map and the Parche study, they have a good idea of where they think the 100-year floodplain elevation is. And if you look at the maps that are in the record, you will see that it contours around the south end of the property and then does cut up against the east end and then go under the railroad culvert. If you also look at the topography, the elevations that are shot on those maps, you will see that the land is fairly level and then has a rapid drop off at the end. When they say that the majority of the land was in the floodplain, that is incorrect. In fact, the city approved two preliminary plats, one back in, I believe it was 2000 or 2001, when he was going to develop all Phase One and Phase Two as one single phase. Once again, they used the firm map and the Lomer of 1999 and the elevations showing, I believe, the minimum finished floors had to be 754. The 752 was the elevation of the 100-year floodplain. These were approved by the city. They allowed Mr. Ray then to proceed with Phase One using the effective floodplain elevation that they adopted. And I'll come back to adoption in a second.
And that's 752?
752.
All right.
Maybe 751. But certainly not 761. Subsequently, Mr. Ray came back in 2006 and wanted to develop Phase Two. Going towards his parcel as a whole argument, it is important that the city severed that first portion, Phase One, from the second portion. They platted the land. Each of those became their own lot. They have their own legal description, lot, block, that is required under state law, and they became their own separate lots. They had houses on them. Then subsequently, Mr. Ray sold them prior to beginning on Phase Two. All of that property is owned by someone else. In the cases that he, or especially the, I believe it's the Murr case, in which he talks about parcels as a whole, that dealt with common ownership between two parcels. We don't have that here. That case is not analogous. Plus, it came out of California, I believe. So, when you're looking at a parcel as a whole, you're looking at common ownership between the two. We don't have that here. The only parcel that is before the court, the only parcel that has been impacted by the city of Crowley is this Phase Two. So that's the only one that we can look at.
2.7 acres.
Correct. Now, when he came back in 2006 to develop it, the preliminary plat for Phase Two was again approved using the effective floodplain elevation of 752. Subsequently, after that was approved, the city came back and required him to do additional studying. The city adopts the floodplain. In the Code of Federal Regulations, it requires municipalities to adopt and manage the floodplain. It is not something that FEMA does. This is something that is implemented by the city. They're the ones that have the most knowledge of the land that's within their jurisdiction and can make recommendations to FEMA. Along those lines, I also have a reference in my brief to the statute in which it is required, or placed in the record, where it is required by the city to certify to FEMA that there have been no changes in the floodplain elevation. In 2009, the city certified that there's no change. The floodplain elevations are the same as they have been since 1999. It is not the obligation of the citizens to make application to FEMA to have the maps changed. It is the responsibility of the city to manage the floodplain and to report back to FEMA if there's any changes in the elevation. The city hasn't done that. And that's one of the things that the trial court focused in on, is that the city from 1999 through today has never changed their effective floodplain elevations. It is still the same 752. And if you look in the final plat, you will see that the one that was approved requiring them to put the minimum finished floors up at 761, I believe, it has the effective floodplain on that map, and it shows it being at 752.
How to get to 761?
It is a requirement that the city of Crowley is arbitrarily imposing on Mr. Ray. No one else has had to raise their minimum finished floors up to that level. No one else has had to bring in fill to their land to develop it. There is development all around this. And Mr. Ray is the only one who has been required to go out and get a new flood study, and that these additional requirements have been imposed on them. And these additional requirements, as the evidence shows in the record, has made development of this land economically unviable. He cannot put one house on this.
Let me ask you this, Ms. Lively. the area with, that is on the 1999 FIRM covers a larger area of ground, of a territory, of just dirt. It covers a larger area than just what's Mr. Ray owns.
Correct.
And with, has the city issued permits for construction in other parts of what is the line showing the flood zone area, the line that, this is the area that we're talking about on the FEMA map, okay? Now, has the city issued permits for construction that is based on this 752 elevation level for the finished floor elevation within that area?
Yes.
The dirt I'm talking about that is not owned by Mr. Ray, but is owned by other people that have made construction, have constructed.
Correct. Everyone else has been able to rely upon the effective LOMA and 100-year floodplain as it was adopted by the city of Crowley.
Mr. Lively, is there any evidence of that in the record?
Yes. Well, there is evidence that no one else has had to do a flood study. I believe one was done, but that's the only one, and that was done in 2005 for a different development. But nothing was ever done to change the floodplain elevation as it was adopted by the city. Nothing was ever reported back to FEMA. So everyone that's in this area, they're still relying upon what the city of Crowley has adopted. And that's another statement that's in the FEMA regulations, is that the city must disseminate this information to the general public so the general public knows where the 100-year floodplain is. This is all the responsibility of the city, not FEMA. FEMA did not, and that goes to the other point that is raised. They try to make this analogous to the Hart's Bluff Game Ranch case. And that was a case in which the company came in, they were trying to buy some lowlands, some marsh area, in order to get the, now I forgot the name of it, but essentially credits that can be sold to other people that want to do development. And the Corps of Engineers ultimately denied that permit. They're called banking permits. And then subsequently, Hart's Bluff sued them, claiming that the state, no, not the Corps, sued the state, claiming the state had violated the Constitution and taken their property. The court came back and stated that it was not the state because the Corps of Engineer is the one who either approves or denies the permits. That's not what we have here. FEMA does not approve or deny these plats. FEMA does not even look at these plats. This is all within the scope of the responsibilities of the city of Crowley to review and approve the applications for plat based upon what the effective floodplain is. And as I keep repeating, the effective floodplain has not changed. And they have certified back, the city has certified back to FEMA that there has been no change. And they have, if there is a different floodplain, if they believe that the NAVE study is correct, then they should have reported 12 years ago that the floodplain is different. But instead, they have not changed the floodplain. The floodplain is there for the citizens of the city of Crowley to rely upon and should govern the development of the land. And they are arbitrarily making him raise his land 10 feet above where the city regulations show the 100-year floodplain is.
How about the September 25th, 2009
that
hydrograph report?
That map does not affect Mr. Ray's property. I believe that was for a different branch of the Deer Creek. There are different forks of Deer Creek. If you look at the map, you'll see they weave around in that area, and they're really actually not even creeks. It's just runoff, so when you do have high amounts of rain, it will feed into the creeks. As I mentioned...
I understand. That's just out of Flatter, Mr. Ray's property.
Correct. But they did certify that there were no other changes to the elevations of Mr. Ray's property over the course. I believe every 2 years they have a requirement that they have to certify that there's been no change to the floodplain elevations. There are several other issues in here. Last one, I think, is the City of Crowley is requesting that the court to find that attorney's fees are not recoverable. That's not something that the court awarded. Therefore, I don't think it is before the court and in court, and it would essentially be an advisory opinion that they are requesting. If the court has any other questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Do you have any disagreement with the findings of fact and conclusions of law as filed by the trial court?
I did not object to any of them, Your Honor, so there are no, I guess, disagreements of, on record.
Not a part of your appeals? Not a part of your response to the appeals? In other words, in your brief, Appellee's brief, I didn't see that there was any place where there were issues raised about the findings of fact and conclusions of law that were filed by Judge Bergwell.
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
And we would take them as true. I believe the basis for an appeal of a denial of a plea to the jurisdiction is that all pleadings and all facts as presented by the plaintiff should be taken as true and deference should be given to the evidence put on by the plaintiff.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Lively.
Thank you.
Mr. Crossed, I'd ask you the same question, and I'll not bother you a lot as you're making your final presentation here, but what is the city's position with regard to direct disagreement with any of the findings of facts and conclusions of laws prepared by the trial court?
Your Honor, despite how this kind of came down, it was very clear that this was a pretrial hearing based on evidence. But it was still a pretrial hearing. And if you look at my brief, it's footnote number 7. I talk about how when you make a ruling on a plea to the jurisdiction, just like when you make a ruling on a motion for summary judgment before trial, you're making a ruling as a matter of law. Therefore, any findings of fact are inappropriate, and they're not binding on this court, and they should be disregarded.
Whether this court, you call them sua sponte findings of fact in your footnote 7.
That is correct. That is correct.
Well, in other words, the trial court did this on their own motion and without binding effect in this decision on the parties?
That is correct. This plea of the jurisdiction was ruled on as a matter of law, therefore the findings of fact and conclusions of law are never binding on this court, but the findings of fact in particular are not binding. The ruling was as a matter of law because it occurred before trial.
Thank you.
I've always heard about that conversation where Judge Bergwell, we think we're about to get out of the case, and he says, hey, I think this is a takings claim. And here we are several years later. There's a couple of things that Mr. Lively brought up. All right. First of all, with respect to nobody else getting the bad treatment here, that is incorrect. As I said at the very beginning, the reason why the floodplain impacts Mr. Ray's property so much more than other surrounding properties is because of the lay of the land, all right?
The railroad.
It's been there since before the city.
I'll ask you the same question I asked Mr. Lively. Is there evidence in the record that others were treated the same way, other landowners were treated the same way as Mr. Ray?
There is not. With respect
to... So as far as the evidence before us, the only example we have of somebody being treated like this is by Mr. Ray, and we have others, according to Mr. Lively, that were not treated the same, that are on the same floodplain.
Well, Your Honor, I'd like to first point out that an equal protection claim has not been alleged, nor could he recover damages under the Texas Constitution.
Just answer my question, please.
That's right.
So there's no evidence of others that were being... Go ahead.
There's a 2005 flood study that was done by Carter Burgess for all of the property upstream, and essentially it came back with discharge, in other words, how much water's in the creek, came back with discharge numbers even higher than the NAVE study. We held them to this high standard, so everyone upstream, under the Carter Burgess study in 2005, it is in the record, it is attached to my first motion for summary judgment, and I think the prior motion for summary judgment, the discharge numbers were higher, and they had to do a unit hydrograph study. Downstream, I don't know. Those houses, if you go under the street, under the railroad, or under the other street, the houses further downstream, they were built in the mid-'80s, mid to late 80s. And I don't think the city joined the National Flood Insurance Program until, I think it's 86. That's not in the record, and that's just me shooting from the hip. So no, there is no evidence in the record that Mr. Ray is being singled out. Further, Your Honor, I point out, this is not an equal protection case. If he wants to allege an equal protection case for damages, he could bring a 1983 action, and I will be moving this case to federal court. But that's not what has been alleged. If we want to allege and say those people are similarly situated, well, then we can do some discovery and figure it out. But right now, that has not been alleged. And he couldn't get damages anyway. There is a plat that is immediately upstream called Longhorn Village. And it looks to me like there's some depictions that show the floodplain extending into the backyard, and that could be evidence, but I don't know why that plat was approved. Again, if they want to allege an equal protection claim.
I've gotten you on a tangent. You can go ahead and move on. I don't have any further questions. It looks like you're out of time, so I'll refer to the head of the panel.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Kloss, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Lively, thank you very much. Gentlemen, we appreciate your arguments, and your case is submitted, and our clerk will adjourn court for the day.